Cool.
Hi, Charlie.
Good afternoon. It's Wednesday, April 8th. This is the Committee on Health, Human Services, and Housing. We have a couple of things on our agenda today. The first is our opportunity as a committee to hear from our legislative auditor, and we're very grateful to the work that you've done. As the committee remembers, last year there was an initiative of changes to the processes that the boards use for disciplinary actions, and that affected all of the boards. Many of those reforms were recommended by the Board of Nursing and were implemented in law. As we had asked them to at a hearing following the reports in the Tribune. And we'd asked them to come forward with suggestions at that time for how we might, as a legislature, assist the Board of Nursing to do a better job at its responsibility for not only making certain that licensed professionals have the appropriate level of expertise, the proper education, be licensed under the rules and regulations that are necessary, but also the important role of making certain that those who have licenses and who care for the public who are in vulnerable situations be engaged in the highest ethical and competency practice. So we did make reforms last year following those reports at the recommendation of the Board of Nursing. At the same time, there was an overview of the Board of Nursing, an evaluation done by the auditor, and that is what it's been completed now, and it's our first opportunity. Thank you and welcome to the committee to help us understand the outcomes of your audit. You. Please begin, Mr. Nobles.
Table is Joe Voss, who is the manager of our evaluation. Madam Chair and members, the state boards that license and regulate health care professionals are an extremely important part of state government, and the work they do is particularly complex and challenging. Their work often requires technical knowledge and expertise, and it often involves balancing competing and even conflicting interests. Given that the work of these boards affects people's lives, and quite often quite profoundly, they should be subject to effective outside oversight and accountability. But achieving that outside oversight and accountability can be difficult because a significant amount of the work that they do is classified as not public and takes place behind closed doors. In that regard, the Office of the Legislative Auditor can help, since state law grants OLA the authority to examine all documents regardless of classification and allows us to observe closed proceedings. We used that authority in our recent evaluation of the Board of Nursing's complaint resolution process. Therefore, we were able to make our judgments about the Board of Nursing based on not just public information about a few cases, but we were able to base our judgments on a comprehensive review of all documents and a large sample of cases. Overall, we concluded that the board's decisions to discipline nurses and dismiss complaints have been generally reasonable, but it has taken too long to suspend some nurses when public safety is at risk. To give you more details about what we found and what we recommend, I want to call on Joe Voss to give you a brief presentation of our report. And again, Madam Chair, thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. Welcome, Ms. Voss.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Joe Voss, and I'm with the Legislative Auditor's Office. Our evaluation focused on the reasonableness, the timeliness, the consistency, and the fairness of nursing board decisions in resolving complaints. We also looked at the board's overall relationship with the Health Professional Services Program, which is an alternative monitoring program for nurses and other licensed health professionals who have problems in terms of substance abuse or physical or mental health problems. Let me start with our bottom line. And as Jim said, we found that board decisions to discipline nurses or take other actions to resolve complaints have generally been reasonable. That is, decisions have generally been appropriate given nurses' violations. However, and this is a big however, we think that it's taken the board too long to resolve some complaints, especially when public safety may be at risk. We have almost two dozen recommendations on pages 91 and 92 of the report. Half are directed at the legislature, half are directed at the Board of Nursing itself. We think that these recommendations will make the complaint resolution process more timely, more consistent, and more fair. I'm only going to cover a few of the recommendations in my presentation today, though. So let me backtrack a bit and provide a little bit of basic information. The first point that I'd like to emphasize, and it's important to remember, is that not that many nurses have complaints filed against them. There are about 118,000 nurses in the state registered to work in Minnesota. Only about 1.5% have any complaints lodged against them in a given year. That being said, the board received about 1,800 complaints in fiscal year 2014. The largest group of complaints involved practice-related problems. That is, nurses not documenting correctly, making treatment mistakes, or working beyond their scope of authority. The second largest group of complaints alleged nurse impairment due to alcohol, drugs, or other physical or mental problems. The board took about 1,800 actions to resolve complaints in 2014. The board resolves almost the vast majority of complaints internally. Very few ever go to the Office of Administrative Hearings to be resolved. Only about 25 a year end up at the Administrative Hearings Office. A key feature of the board's internal process is the discipline conferences. Discipline conferences are run by review panels that consist of one board member and one staff member. An attorney general is also present to provide legal assistance. These discipline conferences serve a couple of purposes. First, it's an opportunity for nurses to come in and actually talk with a board member and talk with a staff member about a complaint. It's the board's practice not to talk to nurses about complaints beforehand. The staff limit their investigatory work to collecting documents and reviewing records. So the discipline conference is also an opportunity for staff to question nurses about the complaint. The ultimate goal of the discipline conference is to hammer out some kind of resolution to the complaint. The agreements hammered out are then sent to the full board for approval. We found that the full board seldom questions review panel recommendations, and it almost always approves the agreements that are worked out in discipline conferences. State law lays out three big types of actions the board can take to resolve complaints, and we define and describe these actions a little bit more on page 10 in our report. The kind of action the board takes dictates the extent to which the information about a complaint is public. Essentially, when the board dismisses a complaint, all information about the complaint is not public. Only the board, the complainant, and the nurse involved knows there was a complaint and knows what happened to the complaint. The board, however, does keep this information forever, and it can and does reopen dismissed complaints if it receives another complaint on the nurse. When the board takes disciplinary action against a nurse, it issues a final order that is public information. The board posts the order online, and everyone can see it. The information is also reported to national databanks. The extent to which non-disciplinary actions are public information varies. Some non-disciplinary actions are reported to national databanks. Some are only available on the state's website, and others are not posted anywhere. Once the board posts information on its website, it stays there forever. Okay, now we're getting into actually our findings. And the first was related to reasonableness. As I said earlier, board actions generally reasonable. The board dismisses most complaints. In 2014, it dismissed about 72% of the complaints that resolved. Now, when we first started doing the evaluation, we looked at this number and thought, 72%, wow, that's pretty high. What's going on here? We looked in great detail at over 300 complaint files in the Board of Nursing and in the Health Professional Services Program. And what we found was that there were legitimate reasons for dismissing so many complaints. In other words, these actions seem reasonable. About 24% of the complaint resolutions involve some type of discipline. In terms of the discipline the board hands out, it's not soft. 43% of all disciplinary actions taken by the board in 2014 involve suspending nurses. Again, these decisions to suspend, as well as decisions to impose other types of disciplinary action, seemed reasonable. In fact, in all of the 300-plus case files that we looked at, we only found one instance where we sort of said, oh, jeepers, they did what? Rest of the time, we saw, yep, that seems to be the most reasonable action to be taken. In terms of timeliness, we found that the board has generally met the statutory requirement that complaints be resolved within a year of receipt. 2014, it took the board about 135 days on average to resolve complaints. It took a little less time, about 107 days, when it dismissed to dismiss complaints, and it took more, 218 days, when it was going to take some other kind of action. We think, though, that it's taken the board too long to suspend nurses when public safety is at risk. In 2014, it took the board, on average, 258 days, which is somewhere around 8 to 9 months, to suspend nurses. This is troubling because nurses can generally work while a complaint is being resolved. Even if a nurse isn't working, there's nothing on that nurse's online record to indicate that the nurse is under investigation. And a prospective employer doing due diligence and checking the nursing board's online nursing records would not see any indication that there might be a problem. We also looked at the extent to which the board has used its authority to issue temporary suspensions. These are reserved for situations where allowing a nurse to continue practicing would present an immediate and a serious risk to the public. In these instances, the board can immediately suspend a nurse and have a hearing afterwards. We found that the board rarely issued temporary suspensions. It did so only 11 times in the last 6 fiscal years. Now, to the board's credit, it has it issued the majority of those suspensions. 7 of the 11 suspensions were issued in fiscal year 2014, so they are using this power a little bit more now than they were previously. However, when the board did use its authority to temporarily suspend, it didn't exactly move quickly. Only once did the board suspend a nurse within a month of getting a complaint. 5 of the 11 suspensions took longer than 4 months to issue. And again, these nurses were free to practice while this was going on. We identified several instances where we thought the board could have and should have acted more quickly than it did. We looked at consistency also, and by consistency we mean that similar complaints are resolved in a similar manner. And our findings here are sort of, there's good news and then there's news that's not quite as good. On the positive side, we found that the board was highly consistent when it came to nurses who admitted diverting drugs. Although the board doesn't have any official written policy in this regard, it almost always suspended nurses for at least a year when they admitted diverting drugs. On the not quite as positive side, we found that the board was inconsistent in resolving some practice complaints when public safety was less of an issue. Now, we looked at this issue in two ways. First of all, we examined all complaints heard in discipline conferences in terms of whether they were dismissed or not. We found that complaints were much more likely to be dismissed when board members who were nurses, as opposed to public board members, served on discipline review panels. Second, we found that the board sometimes used lower-level sanctions to resolve similar complaints interchangeably. For example, similar complaints were sometimes dismissed, sometimes resulted in low-level disciplinary action, such as a fine or a letter of reprimand, or they resulted in non-disciplinary corrective action agreements. While any of these actions might have been reasonable, there appeared to be little rhyme or reason why one option was chosen over another. Part of the problem is that the board has developed few tools to help board members decide what the appropriate actions should be for certain types of violations. We also looked at fairness, and we thought that the process wasn't always fair to nurses. First of all, everything is very legalistic. Not only are all the documents sent to nurses written in a legal fashion, but the discipline conferences are held also in a very legal manner. Now, most nurses do not hire attorneys to help them navigate the complaint process. And we thought that the board could do more to make an already daunting experience just a little more understandable to nurses. And this would be in keeping with Governor Dayton's 2014 executive order that said state agencies should conduct their business in plain English when dealing with the public. We also thought that state law was unduly harsh in making all disciplinary and most non-disciplinary actions public information forever. Given the inconsistency we found in some, in terms of the board decisions in some types of complaints, we don't think this is fair to nurses, nor does it contribute a great deal to increasing public safety. We also thought it was unfair that there was no way for a nurse to sort of gracefully give up their license when health made it impossible for them to practice safely. The only recourse the board has in these situations is to take disciplinary action against a nurse to remove his or her license, even though the nurse has done nothing wrong and no complaint has actually been filed about their practice. We talked with some other health-related licensing boards and found that they grant emeritus status to nurses in these situations without having to go through the discipline process, which we thought was a better alternative. Finally, we looked at the board's working relationship with the Health Professional Services Program, or HPSP. The program is administered by 17 health licensing boards, including the Board of Nursing. People get to HPSP in two ways. The program accepts referrals from the health-related licensing boards that administer it. It also accepts nurses and other licensed professionals who self-refer or are referred there by third parties, such as employers. In these latter instances, the Board of Nursing may not know that the nurses are in the program or that they have a problem that could affect their practice. HPSP monitors licensees with substance abuse or other mental or physical problems to ensure that they can practice safely. It is not a treatment program, although treatment is often an important part of participation. Most of the nurses in HPSP, 79%, have an alcohol or drug-related problem. 54% have an alcohol or drug-related problem in combination with a psychiatric or a medical disorder. We noted in looking at HPSP, and I think the Board of Nursing would agree with us, that HPSP is a very difficult program to successfully complete. Nurses must sign agreements that generally require a 3 to 5 year commitment. These agreements are quite extensive, and on page 74 in our report, page 76, we've listed a lot of the typical requirements of these agreements. For example, if a nurse is in the program for substance abuse problems, they have to call a tox line every single day to find out whether or not they have to go in for a screening that day. The Board of Nursing uses HPSB more than any other licensing board, which is probably not surprising given the large number of nurses in the state. We looked at the percentage of nurses successfully completing HPSB over the last 4 years. We found that 48% of the nurses successfully completed the program, compared with a 59% success rate for other health licensed professionals. We asked board staff and HPSP staff why the Board of Nursing had a lower success rate. We were told that one reason is that the Board of Nursing expects HPSP to discharge nurses when they don't comply with monitoring requirements. Other health licensing boards are more likely to ask HPSP to keep their licensees in the program. Another reason has to do with costs. Although nurses don't have to pay for being monitored, they do have to pay for their tox screens, they have to pay for treatment, and if a nurse isn't working, these costs can run up quite rapidly. We identified two major sources of conflict regarding the Board of Nursing's relationship with HPSP, and the first one has to do with the confidentiality of the program. In theory, the Board of Nursing has no knowledge of nurses who self-refer to HPSP or are referred there by third parties such as employers. This is about half of all nurses referred to the program come via self-referrals or third-party referrals. The Board of Nursing will only learn that they're in the program if HPSP reports these nurses for noncompliance or discharges them for any reason other than successful completion. The confidentiality issue sort of revolves around public safety. The Board of Nursing's concern is that it can't protect the public when nurses have complaints filed against them if staff don't know the nurses are in HPSP. HPSP says that reporting these nurses to the Board of Nursing would decrease public safety because these nurses wouldn't enroll in HPSP in the first place. And there's some merit to both arguments. So we looked at how big this problem actually is. Over half of the nurses who self-refer or are referred by third parties to HPSP eventually come to the board's attention because they don't comply with monitoring requirements, and HPSP reports them. We looked at the nurses who, in theory, the board didn't know were in HPSP, and we found that 17% of those nurses who successfully completed HPSP in the last 4 years had complaints filed against them while they were in HPSP, and the board didn't know they were in the program. Furthermore, 23% of the nurses who successfully completed HPSP in 2000 through 2004 without the board knowing they were in the program later had complaints filed against them. Again, the board didn't know they had successfully completed HPSP. While these numbers are not huge, they're not insignificant either. Second issue of concern has to do with basic philosophical differences between the two programs. As I alluded to before, the board and HPSP each approach public safety aspect of their work from different angles. Neither side is wrong. HPSP, though, has developed one set of policies to cover all 17 health licensing boards. Now, the Board of Nursing would argue, and we would agree, that nurses present unique risks to vulnerable patients that some other health licensed professionals do not. For example, few other health professionals have access to patients' homes and narcotic drugs to the extent that nurses do. Few other professionals are as responsible for day-to-day and often minute-to-minute care as nurses are. HPSP's policies do not take these factors into consideration. So what do we recommend? Well, first of all, we think the legislature should give board staff greater authority to investigate complaints. Now board staff don't think they can investigate complaints outside of discipline conferences. It should also give board staff greater authority to dismiss complaints. Current law requires two board members to sign off on all dismissals, and we think that given the large number of dismissals and the subject matter of the complaint in the first place, this is overkill. We also think that the legislature should allow the board to expunge certain information from nurses' public records when appropriate. And the board should be allowed to issue emeritus licenses to allow some nurses to retire more gracefully, I guess. Regarding the confidentiality issue in HPSP, we think we have a very practical solution to the problem. We think the legislature should require the Board of Nursing to send HPSP a list of nurses who have complaints filed against them, where HPSP staff would identify whether or not those nurses are currently enrolled in the program. We don't think it's necessary for the board to know about all nurses in HPSP if they're being successful and they haven't had any complaints lodged against them. For the board, we think the board should make greater and quicker use of its temporary suspension authority. We think the board should give staff greater authority to propose settlements in cases where violations do not pose a major risk to the public. We also think the board needs to develop administrative rules or guidelines to help board members determine appropriate actions for certain types of complaints. And we also point out a number of other areas in our report where we think more definitive guidance is needed. Finally, we think the board and HPSP should work together to develop nurse-specific policies and procedures. And that is our study in a nutshell.
Well, thank you.
I'd be happy to take questions.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate your coming, and I would like to ask a few questions, and we'll open it to all of you to ask questions.
Where do I want to begin here?
You described at some point here that that there's an inconsistency in those things that become that in the disciplinary action for the lower level dismissal and non-disciplinary complaints, and that you noticed that the dismissal might occur more readily with a professional person than with a licensed holder as opposed to a public member, public person. And then later you talked about giving relief to the nurses for that being becoming public and being on a website as a reportable issue. What confused me about that is that I thought in another moment you indicated that these lower level dismissal and non-disciplinary actions are not made public anyway. Is that, did I misunderstand what you were saying?
Madam Chair, all disciplinary actions are public information and remain on a nurse's record forever. Non-disciplinary actions, some are public information and do remain on a nurse's record forever. For example, if a nurse has an agreement for corrective action, if the board is requiring the nurse to take a remedial course in something, that would remain on the license forever.
Okay, thank you. And in the Tribune article that sort of got a lot of this conversation going, we understand clearly that some of the information is not made available to the public that you were able to have access to. And so, you know, the story is written based on certain limited information. But it did suggest, the articles were suggesting that the board was really not appropriately responding or addressing the lapses of ethical or competency or histories of diverting drugs, that there was a lack of attention being placed by the Board of Nursing on some pretty consistent violations of clinical practice by nurses. And I think what you're saying to us, that based on further examination, looking more closely at the data, that that is not the case. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, when we reviewed over 300 files, we found that the board's actions were appropriate. They weren't always timely. They didn't always have information available to them to act sooner than they did. The action they finally took, we thought, was appropriate. I think they could have been much more timely in several instances.
Thank you. And were you able to determine why they did not have the information they needed in order to take a more assertive intervention, if that was appropriate?
Madam Chair, the board does very little investigation on its own outside of subpoenaing records and going through documents. If they want to talk with nurses and talk with other people, they generally call the nurse into a discipline conference. Calling a nurse into a discipline conference generally adds about 100 days more to the process. So they don't always have the nurse's side of the story, and they can't always question the nurse about his or her actions outside of the conference. Also, there has some reporters, mandated reporters, will report issues and problems to the Health Professional Services Program if the nurse is in that program. And that information may or may not be relayed back to the Board of Nursing if it's a practice-related, if the practice-related issue is related to the nurse's illness in the first place.
So, would you say that again? I think I got the first part.
Okay.
When
a nurse is having problems or issues while she or he is a HPSP participant.
And problems while they're a participant might mean what? What does that mean, a problem?
Let's say they're coming to work late, or they're not documenting things correctly. And HPSP determines that problem is related to that nurse's illness. It's related to their substance abuse problem, for example. They do not have to report that to the Board of Nursing. If they determine the problem is not related to a practice issue, then they will report that to the Board of Nursing. So some of the practice things, some of the problems may not get reported in a timely way to the Board of Nursing.
And did you have a recommendation about that?
Madam Chair, one of the recommendations that we have is that HPSP and the Board of Nursing need to develop some more nurse-specific policies and procedures for how they want to proceed, especially in the area of, you know, is a practice-related problem related to the illness or is it not related to the illness? And I think that because the Board of Nursing, those staff people are nurses, they may be able to provide a different perspective to HPSP. So we think that they should be talking with one another more and developing some written policies in those areas about what should be reported, what are the sorts of questions that HPSP should ask of their participants to determine, mm-hmm. you know, to try to get at the problem of why this issue came up in the first place.
Thank you. I think that's important as well because from my perspective, if diverting drugs is related to their chemical dependency issues, it still is diverting drugs and creating public safety. So I would wonder why that wouldn't be reported or if the person was doing, you know, I'm assuming that much of what's happening, especially around diversion of drugs or coming to work under the influence of alcohol or something, may be related to their addiction illness, but it's the question here is about not using that as a way of not reporting something that the board needs to know in order to protect the public from a person who's not managing their illness.
Madam Chair, when it comes to diverting drugs, HPSP is pretty much, they're going to report that to the Board of Nursing. Now, when it comes to other issues such as maybe coming to work impaired, I know we, in our case file review, we looked at some instances where that might be an instance where HPSP might call the board and sort of say, is this the sort of thing you want reported to you or not? Sometimes the board has said yes, sometimes the board has said no. There's a little inconsistency in some of the unofficial things that happen between the board and HPSB. And we think instead of having staff to call and say, in this kind of case, what do you want us to do? They should have something worked out, written down, so that there's clear guidance one way or the other.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Regarding the drug diversion issue, big issue, recurrent problems in that area, did we not, and maybe actually this is a question for council, didn't we pass legislation in the last couple of years that required that the board be notified if an employee was diverting drugs? I think that legislation passed, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Yep. So in that case, if there's known drug diversion, the board does know. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Senator Nelson, yes, HPSB has generally always reported drug diversion to the Board of Nursing. Many of the changes that you're talking about that the legislature adopted last year just became effective sort of midpoint in our evaluation. And so it was almost too late for us to look at whether or not.
Thank you, Ms. Foss. Before you came, Senator Nelson, I'd mentioned that this audit was occurring at the same time that the board was bringing forward those reforms that you're talking about. So
yes,
some of what is in the auditor's report has already been initiated in terms of changes in the legislature. So.
Madam Chair,
could we have KJ Starr make an addition?
Thank you. Introduce yourself.
KJ Starr with the auditor's office. Just to clarify, the legislation that passed last year required employers who discover employees' diversion independently of HPSB enrollment. So if an employee can report themselves to HPSB for diversion and the employer doesn't know of the diversion, then HPSB is not required to report the diversion to the board. What Ms. Voss was speaking of is if someone diverts while in the program, HPSB will report that to the board. So the legislation passed last year is actually much narrower than all diversion is reported to the board. So if an employer learns of the diversion from the employee because of their HPSB enrollment, that is not reported.
So, Madam Chair.
Senator Nelson.
Oh, yeah, so this is all coming back to me. That was my legislation, and now I remember how this all it changed a little bit as it went through the process. So would it be a recommendation then that all drug diversions, whether they're self-reported to HPSB or known by the employer, be reported to the Board of Nursing?
Ms. Voss, excuse me.
Sorry.
Would you please say your names for whoever's going to be answering the questions? For the record.
I'm KJ Starr. We do have a more narrow recommendation in this area on page 90. We did not go and make a recommendation about all diversion, but we did identify something of a loophole where we felt that if an employer learned of diversion from an employee's HPSB participation and patient harm had occurred as a result of the diversion, that employer should report that to HPSB whether or not they were in the program. So we made a much more narrow recommendation than you asked.
Okay. Thank you.
And, of course, I have concerns about how you're going to define harm. So that's the question here.
Right.
It really is a measure of a decision-making or a judgment process of a nurse if they're going to take somebody's drug. So we have a lot to talk about
Madam
here.
Can I just add one thing?
Yes, Senator Nelson, and then Senator Marty has a question.
Yeah,
then
just
we
briefly,
have another.
When it comes to drug diversion, that's a very serious thing. That is not just someone who has a problem with alcohol or, well, in this case, drugs, highly addictive drugs. When it comes to diverting patient drugs, we're talking about hardcore users or people with very significant problems. So I think it does bear that we should take a closer look at this, because I'm very uncomfortable with any drug diversion and having nurses or anyone who is diverting patient drugs for personal use not reported to the licensing board. I think that is a huge hole.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Senator Nelson. I know Senator Marty has a question.
Yeah, Madam Chair, the slide on fairness, it was, you talked about two things there, and I see on page 53 and so on, you have stuff there. First of all, the legalistic language instead of the plain English, is that something, is that Board of Nursing ability to do that without legislation? That's what I sort of read in the report, but that, is that the case?
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, we think the board could put more information about the complaint process on their website. They could explain it in greater detail in plain English. They also, they send notices to nurses about the complaints and about having to appear at a discipline conference. These are very legalistic. Maybe they need to keep those legalistic, but they could also include a cover letter which says something in plain English. We sat through many discipline conferences, and the legal language used to tell nurses of their rights, you know, my eyes glazed over. I'm sure theirs were too.
I understand.
And Madam Chair, on that same slide,
Senator Marty,
the no way for nurses to give up their licenses when health makes it impossible to practice safely, I thought that was really sad to see that. You say some other licensing boards do give a soft landing type of thing, people who did nothing wrong but they realize they can't practice safely. Do you know if all, and is that requires legislation to allow that sort of thing? And if so, do you know how many of our licensing boards have that?
We just had legislation in front of us from the Board of Social Work, who instituted an emeritus program in their legislation. So there may be others. Do you know, Ms. Voss?
I know, Senator Marty, I know the Board of Medical Examiners, Medical Practice, they have an emeritus status, I believe.
Madam Chair, your report says medical practice, chiropractors, and pharmacy.
Okay.
Those are the only ones you're aware of, obviously.
And then we have one this year.
I think I talked to about eight of the health. I tried to talk with health licensing boards that sort of were more physical as opposed to social work and marriage counselors and things. And those were the three of the eight that I know told me that they did grant emeritus.
Okay, Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, on that point, I do think we ought to be looking at all of them, because when somebody hasn't done anything wrong, they've served well, but for whatever health issue, they cannot keep practicing, we ought to make it so they don't have to be disciplined out of the profession, but they can just agree to stop practicing and so on. So I think that's worth us, if that's a legislative thing, us taking a look at all those. And then real briefly about the HPSP thing, I understand and agree with your idea that the board and HPSP should try and work together on what best procedures are, but I also think we got to be cautious about the idea that I very much think that I noticed the HPSP comment letter in the back talks about how determinations on what should be done should be not profession specific but behavior specific, and that it seems to me whatever the changes are, they should be across the board. I'm just wondering why you said profession specific in one of your recommendations, page 90 or 92 or whatever. Why did you say that? I'm just curious.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, we did not do an evaluation of HPSP. We pretty much just focused on HPSP's relationship with the Board of Nursing. And so the Board of Nursing, nurses presents unique risks. If we would have looked perhaps at the Board at HPSB more broadly and looked at how it dealt with all of the health licensing boards, we might have used the words risk-specific policies, that some of the professions, such as doctors, probably have more of a risk. Their behavior represents more of a risk to the public than, let's say, marriage counselors. And we might have used a different word than nurse-specific, but we only looked at really at the Board of Nursing.
Senator Marty, and then Senator Eaton, and then we have Ms. Brecken here from the Board of Nursing, who has a document that we'll distribute here, a summary of her comments in the House. I just want to remind the committee, I was hoping that we could get through two things today, and we do want to review the child protection funding formulas also today. So, you know, let's give this another maybe 15 minutes or 10 minutes, and then it allows us enough time for you to ask questions about this other component. So thank you. Did you want to ask
one
again, Senator Marty?
Quick comment then, and that is that I think we should be looking at all the programs together, because HPSB has, I think, an important public safety, public health, and public well-being in all of these professions. I think if a doctor or nurse or somebody is struggling with health issues, any way we can get them into the program, and I think it's a good program, and I think it's worth defending and so on in the when you get to the data, who's sharing what with so-and-so, I think it does have an impact on who's willing to go into a program. And part of these boards, I think the boards, all of these boards should be looking at the public interest, and that doesn't mean we're going to take out anybody here. We're going to try and help our people be good professionals. I think that's what HPSB is about, and I hope we can. I just was concerned because it sounded like, well, let's do it for nurses this way, and I think there are plenty of them have high-risk things. We should deal with it the same way.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess my comment was about the drug diversion, and while I agree it's a very serious issue, I would think that the purpose of the self-referral is people who wouldn't be likely to self-report that would then do so because they recognize their problem and because of the rules and the surrounding the HPSP where this would not be immediately reported, that they would be more inclined to do it than not, that this is a big public safety piece of this, which I feel like takes some defending when people want to be more punitive than preventative. So I guess I strongly believe in the self-reporting part and the fact that people are able to get their issues resolved through HPSP unless they are, you know, they violate that program.
Thank you, Senator Eaton. Just one last question on this issue. You indicated somewhere in the conversation that the Board of Nursing has an expectation that if a person fails to meet the criteria under the HPSP program for monitoring their practice so that they are safe while they're practicing and still licensed, whether they're self-referred or not, does that apply? Because if they're self-referred, does the HPSP apply the same requirements to them as a non-self-referred person? Because I know that if the self-referred person fails, then they get reported to even the self-referred person gets reported to the Board of Nursing. So the question is whether the requirements that are placed on HPSP, I'm sorry if I'm saying this wrong, for how they manage the oversight of a nurse who is sent there to that program, are they the same whether they're self-referred or if they're referred by the Board of Nursing?
Madam Chair, if you are participating in the program under discipline, the board knows everything about you in the program. If you are late for work a couple of days and it's reported to HPSP, HPSP will report that to the nursing board. They follow, they know everything. If you're self-referred, do you want to?
Madam Chair, if they're self-referred, there's always certain rules that apply to everybody. For example, if you fail a tox screen, whether you're self-referred or board-referred, that will be reported to the board. But whether it's a program violation, there's some room for judgment. And there are, actually, Monica Feiter from HPSB is here, so she might be able to answer your question more specifically, because there is some difference.
There may be some. That's the only thing that I think we can get into, not into the woods on this today because of our time. But maybe we'll, if the members of the committee want to spend more time with you, we'll invite you back another time. Yeah, I'd like to invite Ms. Brecken to the table as well. I appreciate your being here today, and I know that you have this much more thorough presentation in writing for us to review, but I just thought it might be important for you to maybe highlight some things for us and offer an opportunity for the committee to ask you some questions.
Evaluation because of a series of articles that were in the newspaper regarding the board's concern that the board's actions were not appropriate. And in fact, the report, indeed, overall, the evaluators did conclude that the board's actions have been reasonable and they provided the public with a high degree of protection. The evaluation also found that the board's decision to dismiss complaints or take action were appropriate given the nurse's violations and the complaint outcomes have adequately protected the public. The report concludes also that the board used the most serious action, that is suspension or revocation, in situations where the public has been at risk. And I quote from the report, if anything, the board has tended to err on the side of public safety in disciplining nurses. And so I really want you to know that the board appreciates that conclusion in the report. The evaluators also looked at the rate of dismissals and noted that while there are problems with how dismissals are reported, the evaluators found the board staff are diligent in assuring that they have the whole picture when they evaluate complaints, and they use their expertise as nurses to help them understand the circumstances surrounding complaints and to assist them in conducting discipline conference interviews. The report also found that the board seeks to dismiss cases or discipline against a nurse who would serve no public protection purpose, such as in cases of human error or when circumstances leading to an incident fall outside the control of the nurse. I especially appreciate the evaluator's validation of the staff's expertise and diligence. The report does conclude that the board has taken too long to resolve some complaints where the public would be at risk, and the board agrees with this finding. This is an area of concern for the board. And in fact, the board actually conducted a Kaizen experience, a Kaizen, to look at ways that they could, that the board can reduce the number of days or the cycle time that it takes from the time a complaint comes into the board and action is taken by the board. And in fact, the board actually reduced that cycle time to about 135 days, as the report showed. However, the report goes on to look at actions individually, different types of actions, and how long it took to do those actions. And that's a very important difference in how we have been looking at it, and we appreciate that greater analysis for those cases, you know, that will help us to look at it. Additionally, we have decided that that in those cases when it falls outside the norm in terms of resolution of the case, that conducting a root cause analysis for those type of cases would be very helpful to determine just why and what we could do about that. I also appreciated the comment of Ms. Voss in regards to consistency of resolving the even though they found some inconsistency, as you said, for those lower-level complaints, they did conclude that despite these inconsistencies with these practice-related complaints, they did not find any case where the action that was imposed by the board was grossly disproportionate, that is, too lenient or too strict for the act that was committed. In terms of the fairness and the plain language, I would tell you that this is an area that the board has already started working on, and in fact has started working on it on many of our application forms. We have not yet gotten to our discipline forms, that is, notices of conference or notice of hearing, indeed we are working on that at this time. As to the relationship with the Health Professional Services Program, I want you to know that the Board of Nursing values the HPSP highly. In fact, it was the Board of Nursing and the Board of Medical Practice that actually sought the legislation in 1994 to develop the Health Professional Services Program. The Board does appreciate that the evaluators recognize that nurses work in situations that might present unique risks to vulnerable patients in ways that some other health professionals don't. That nurses have access to drugs in the way that many other health professionals don't. But the board also appreciates the challenge to the health professional staff to have their specific policies, procedures, and mechanisms, which may be different than monitoring the other healthcare professionals. And the board is committed to collaborating with HPSP staff to provide effective and efficient reporting decisions that support public protection. I'm not going to go into any more detail.
Thank you.
Report, but I'll tell you it's been quite a journey.
Yes.
And given all that, we are pleased to have the report. It will facilitate the board to develop a roadmap for process improvement. And I thank you for your attention to this report and supporting the board in this work. And I understand any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Brecken, and I want to say to you as well that I know the articles were very, very difficult for the Board of Nursing to have very little opportunity to defend because of the privacy issues that are involved. So I think that that the audit is, in a way, very helpful to you in two ways, to answer some of the questions that might have been in the public in relationship to that, but also to give you a review of your system that as you indicated, you just don't have the resources to do very often and suggestions for improvement. So I think that's fabulous. I was going to ask you a question, but I can't remember. Do you have a plan based on what you have discovered to bring things forward legislatively next year to implement some of what is in this report? It would be helpful to us if you would, or certainly to, I would like this, and I think the other members of the committee, if you could summarize those considerations, those things that you think you can do internally, like improving the language that you use and communications, internal processes that you're going to change in order to shorten the time frame, and then those, you know, include those things, and then those things that you think require us to extend some legislative authority to you in the upcoming time. And I just want to make sure, I have to cut us off here, so I just want to make sure. Senator Eaton?
I just wanted to ask Ms. Brecken if your intention would be, once the board has made some determinations, to work with other stakeholder groups and get input and buy-in from other interested parties.
Ms. Brecken?
Other stakeholders that will identify as they work through the process.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Brecken, does that have to be approved, voted on by the board, or is that just something that you hand to us and that it'll be approved by the board?
Yes. Ms. Brecken?
I'm not clear on your question, so I interrupt you, because it is the board that is actually looking at the report. It's not the board staff. I mean, the board staff is involved with it, but it's the board members that are reviewing the report and making those determinations.
Madam Chair, and then
Senator Rosen.
The board would have to vote on all those recommendations, is the question. I'm sorry. I didn't.
Chair,
Ms. Brecken?
Yes, I think anything that the board would make a determination to go forward with would be my motion.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Nothing further? Well, thank you, Ms. Brecken. I'm sorry to not give you more time to be able to talk with us, but we've got another agenda item. This is the way it is. This. Yes. Great. Appreciate it. Thank you very much. And thank you also to the Auditor's Office for your fabulous presentation and the work you did on behalf of this board and the legislature and the public. I mean, it's the public that you really are serving. So thank you very much. Okay, we're now going to hand out to you something that I think that was emailed to you. So you it's not was posted anyway for you to review. And I would invite... Ralph McCorder, and I see there is Jim Koppel here from the Department of Human Services. If he is here, I'd like you to come forward this time. Is he here or hiding? And anyone else that that you might want to invite forward at this time. I'm going to stay here in the chair. We really are not having a hearing. This is simply something that I thought was important to do. So to give you some context, remember Senate File 4, which is the child protection recommendations of that came from the task force that Senator Rosen and I sit on, that was the first set of recommendations that was submitted December 31st. This task force, appointed by the governor, has continued to meet since then and has completed its work and made its final recommendations about 2 weeks ago and is available to you as well. What we're talking about today is Senate File 4, which is the recommendations that came forward by December 31st. As you know, there's nothing in Senate File 4 nor are we going to add it, are we adding the recommendations from the rest of the recommendations of the task force. Those will be coming forward in other legislation in the future. But the resource committee of the task force continued to work and take a look at resources for all of the recommendations that the task force made, including those that were incorporated in Senate File 4. And the conclusion of the work about that was not completed till after our deadlines. So Senate File 4 is now in finance. We're going to be talking about the financial issues related to Senate File 4 in finance in the next couple of weeks. But I just thought it might be good if you would like to have a presentation on how what the financial components are, not so much the finance numbers as it is the work that's been done by the task force, representatives of the task force, representatives of the counties, representative of the department, about how to fund what is what the demands are going to be as a result of Senate File 4. So the issue in front of you or for our conversation or what I'm offering you an opportunity to talk about today is how we've decided to take the funding demands and distribute those resources. And that's what's in front of you, and that's what I'm hoping that that you will make absolutely clear to this committee before we move into finance. And I think Mr. McCorder, he's been working with the task force subcommittee on resources for a long time. He's worked, has county representatives coming in, met with a lot of stakeholders that have come up with this methodology, which I think is a public policy discussion that we need to have. Mr. Koppel.
Okay. Madam Chair and members, I'm Jim Koppel, the Assistant Commissioner for Children and Family Services. I just want to make a couple of brief comments, and then I'm going to hand it over to Mr. McCorder here, who will walk through the formula. And it's the formula both for the staffing funds, and that was what was part of the governor's supplemental budget. And that's kind of what I wanted. If you think, Madam Chair, that would be helpful, that this first part is part of the governor's supplemental budget. Then there's also an additional allocation on county services, which is separate from that. So just to be clear, there are two different allocations. The first one is part of the supplemental budget, which this in particular was $22 million a year in the supplemental budget for county staffing. So that's the formula for county staffing funds. And then there's this on the second, on page two, line 18 is the child protection grant allocation county for county services. And so they're two separate funds, but they both follow formulas that Mr. McWhorter will now walk through.
May I restate what you're saying, Mr. Koppel? You know, when we do Senate File 4 as a it's a legislative bill proposal, and then we determine what the fiscal note is on it. We determine what the fiscal note is on it. What you're saying is that what we're proposing out of the Resource Committee and what it is that we're doing here is not completely funded in the governor's supplemental budget. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it is not going to be funded in the end. It's just that he has his budget, we're going to create our budget. Is that correct, Mr. Koppel?
Madam Chair, that's perfect.
I just wanted to be clear about that. And you are saying to us that as it relates to the governor's proposal in his supplemental budget, he does account for the first provision here, which is the staffing, increased staffing requirements at the county level, but does not provide for what are anticipated based on the research that we've done in the Resource Committee to be the additional services that will be needed for the children that are coming into the child protection system. But we do account for that in the Senate file. Okay.
Correct,
okay.
Madam Chair.
Is everybody clear about that? Very good. Okay, Mr. McWhorter.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ralph McWhorter. I'm Minnesota Department of Human Services.
Can you pull your microphone forward?
A little more forward, okay. Madam Chair, Ralph McWhorter from Minnesota Department of Human Services. And a little context, you already provided the fact that the governor issued a raise.
Pulled it too far forward.
Maybe that's what the problem is.
Am I still on? That the governor issued the formation of the Task Force on Child Protection in September. That task force met, issued preliminary recommendations in December, and has just finalized those final recommendations as of March 31st. That set the stage for the discussions with the county and state fiscal work group to think through and analyze what impact of the recommendations that were coming out of the task force work would have on both state oversight and county practice and delivery of services. And so to that extent, we actually formed a group that included several counties, both small, medium, and large, to look at the specific recommendations that were kind of the main points of focus of the task force work. And we developed a methodology to think through what it would take to have county workers carry out the work related to the intake process and the casework involved as a result of changes to the definitions and the process by which they engage families in work on child protection issues. And so that task force focused on the staffing issues first. And so the first part of our discussion today is on what the analysis was of that the work through that. The formula is a representation of I'll say, some of our best thinking, but I can't speak for the counties in that process. They'll have to speak for themselves as an association about their support of it. But I do know it was a working effort to figure out what the impact would be of changing the process as a result of the recommendations of the task force. So to that extent, the formula in Subdivision 1 on the first page of the document that you have speaks to trying to make sure that staffing is provided in a targeted fashion, and with the understanding that there's a potential pool of children that might come to the attention of a county. that there is a pool of children that it will become to, through the intake process, and then there's another smaller pool of children that actually have open child protection cases. And so to that extent, the formula looks at those factors in determining what the allocation would be, and that happens in lines 1.3 to 1.115. What it has a representation of 50% of the formula based on the county population. That'll impact the size. Larger counties would get more money. 25% would be based on the screened-in reports, and 25% would be on the open child protection case management cases. This should reflect the kind of work that counties are having to do as a result of the recommendations. But we understand that there are small counties who would not get enough of an allocation to be able to do the considerable amount of work expected of them. And so there is a guaranteed floor identified in the formula that no county would get less than $75,000. And in this discussions with the county state fiscal work group, that was an agreement that seemed to represent at least the value of one whole worker to do work focused on those recommendations. And so there's about 30 counties as a result of the guaranteed floor. They get a little bit more money because of the guaranteed floor. You'll see in subdivision 2 of that first page, lines 1.16 to 1.19, that there's no supplantation. The task force work group on resources, I think, was pretty clear that they wanted to make sure that counties weren't able to bank the funds and use them for other purposes. There was a kind of a clear expectation that those funds would be used for adding staff to carry out the work expected of them by the task force. Subdivision 3 represents the payment process to counties, and those are lines 1.20 to 2.13. 80% of the funds would go out up front in the state fiscal year in July. And those funds are made available right away to the counties to beef up their staffing to do the work. But there's also a withhold of their full allocation. They'll only get 80% up front, and we hold back 20% for later in the year to determine two things. One, are they actually doing timely face-to-face contacts? And two, are they actually doing the monthly caseworker case visits for children in foster care and children who are receiving child protection services while residing in the home? The concept there is that unless they're doing the work, they shouldn't get the full allocation. And the work is required by the task force is that they seek children early, right away, if there's been an allegation of maltreatment, and they see children constantly if those children are in need of child protective services. And then you'll see in lines 2.14 to 2.17 that the commissioner would work with stakeholders and Human Service Performance Council to move off of that performance level of face-to-face and monthly caseworker visits to outcome measures. So the recognition that the performance measures are an expectation on the front end of developing this process, but later on we actually want to see outcomes for children improved, not just workers showing up at the door and being visible. So if that makes sense, move on to the county services section.
Are there any questions on this? I just wanted to raise this for you to understand that we didn't have a chance to take a look at the policy language here, and what we're trying to do is not supplant. We're making sure that this money goes for child protection staffing,
right?
And because the counties have indicated to us the need to increase that, and so we just want to make sure that's happening. That's based on performance, and I know the counties can speak for themselves, but they were involved through the entire process.
Yes, they were.
I wouldn't want the committee to have the impression that they haven't been fully engaged in this conversation. So this is just the first of two. The next section we're going to talk to about services and how the money, this is a $10 million appropriation that will be distributed in a similar way, a similar formula. But we'll go to that after there's questions on this first section, the $22 million for staffing. And Senator Hayden, did I understand you had a question?
Quickly. Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. McQuarters, right, Mr. So I was just trying to walk through this a little bit. I haven't had a lot of time to look at it. So if we're funding based on the actual investigations, right, versus the number of screenings in total. So I'm just walking, if I'm off the mark, I guess I'm trying to make sure, I'm trying to figure out that we don't, are we, is there potential for us to create a perverse incentive that if the funding is tied to investigations versus screenings, that then potentially, I mean, I know that our counties wouldn't do this, but is there the opportunity for people to push, or for counties to push more towards the, to open an investigation, because that means that they would receive more funding versus just total amount of screenings to ensure that we're catching everybody?
Madam, Mr. Recorder, this is a...
Madam Chair.
We've had this conversation, so it's interesting.
I'm sorry.
No, sorry. It's just right on. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, what I think this formula reflects, I think, the intention of the task force to actually have more child protection work occur, that the reflection of the review of the task force was that there wasn't sufficient county engagement. So I think to the extent everyone's sensitive to the issue of perverse incentive, there's an expectation there will be more county work to do the job that's expected based on the recommendations of the task force. And,
Mr. Koppel?
Madam Chair and Senator Hayden, I think it's a good point you raise, and I think what we tried to do is a balance, and that's where the 50% of children population, the child population, which would represent that broader scope, and then the more narrow is, once you're in the system and screened in, there is an intensive amount of work that needs to be done, and we want to make sure caseloads and the staffing and that work gets done. So there is a balance between the two, and that's where we tried to achieve.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen, did you have a question?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I was just, Mr. McCorder, the Human Services Performance Council, the specific outcome measures will be developed by Human Service, your department, or in coordination with other stakeholders. Is that correct?
Mr. McCorder?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, there is a formal process in 402A with the Human Service Performance Council, and the commissioner and Commissioner Tony Carter is a representative on that council, so she'll be very well informed of the work that we're trying to accomplish, I believe, in that process. But
did you want to say something further, Mr. Koppel?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, I think this will be coordinated. It will also involve other stakeholders as well that we'll seek out. We wanted it to be as transparent and open as possible to get the credibility that's needed when we do come out with those outcome measures. That's the challenge we face right now. We wish we had those outcome measures to start right now, but that we hope that in a couple of years we'll be there.
Okay, let's move to the second portion of the bill, which now takes $10 million for what is anticipated to be an increased demand for services as a result of the reforms.
Correct, Madam Chair. So we're on page 2, lines 18, is the start of the discussion about county services and that allocation process. And what you'll see on the front end in subdivision 1 at 2.20 is the same formula on the front end for the allocation for services as for staffing, because the assumption here is that the same cases are being in front of the counties. So the general demographic of children who might potentially be involved in child welfare, the smaller group of screened-in reports that will occur, and then the number of open child protection cases that are actually occurring. So the concept is those are the families who'd be needing the services. And so we're really putting parallel on the allocation model, both the staffing level and the service delivery aspect, based on who we think is a potential people in need of both county oversight through staffing and the delivery of services. Here, though, the guaranteed floor is $30,000, and there's about 26 counties who benefit from having that guaranteed floor. So what we're saying both on the staffing and on the services is even the smallest county would be getting something to establish a minimum threshold baseline to support the recommendations of the task force. You'll see on 2.33 to 2.35 the no supplantation of existing funds again. And subdivision 3 comes the focus on eligible services. And so we provided examples of the eligible services when the county state fiscal work group looked at the range of services that counties both provide to their own staff versus purchase services outside of out-of-home care. These are the services that are delivered through by counties purchasing it through their support, nonprofit contractors and others to support those open child protection cases. You'll also see in that listing that we've also included the option for additional funding to move children who are in child protection off of waiting lists in other service categories that would stabilize the child and the family. And so you'll see references to child care, Head Start, home visiting. Just to move them off of the waiting list, while they're in a child protection situation, we don't want them to be sitting off, not getting a service because they're waiting for it somewhere else. In the payment area on lines 3.17 to 3.28, you'll see that, again, there's a withhold that occurs. Here it's 80% they get up front. They know that's available to provide services to the families. And we withhold the 20% just to ensure that they've actually expanded the services to those children in the child protection cases. So that one's just a little bit different. It's not performance-based there, whereas in the staffing, we have the performance-based withhold related to timely face-to-face visits and monthly caseworker face-to-face visits. So in essence, I'll repeat myself, the task force expected more engagement by child protection intake workers, child protection caseworkers, child protection aides, supervisors to oversee the children in need. And the model here is a county staffing support aspect and a county service aspect as well. And as Commissioner Koppel indicated, the governor's proposal is parallel in that the governor's proposal is supporting the staffing positions and state oversight and some funds for disparity grants of $3 million. The pages in front of you support county staffing and $10 million worth of county services to support families in those situations.
Thank you. I did want to emphasize that much of this did come out of conversations and reports that came to the task force. For example, when issues, what are the problems that the system is dealing with? For example, where you see the funds can be for services like Head Start, child care, what we discovered is that there are children that are in need of services that are identified, brought into the child protection service system. They might be done through the old system of family assessment in which there was not an investigation occurring, but they were sitting there in that system without our ability to be able to get them into Head Start or into these various programs that they needed to start supporting that child for a better outcome. And that was really a critical set of feedback that the task force received as we were in those hearings. And we were trying to address that in this language. My question, and I'll open it to others as well, is one of the things that we discovered in the task force is this very broad range, very big differential in terms of the number of dollars per child spent in various counties. And it ranged, if my memory is right, from as low as $99 or $100 up to $600. It was quite a big range. So part of what we wanted to address here is that we want to make sure that we recognize the commitment that some counties made in spite of deficits and cuts that have occurred to child protection, while recognizing that other counties may have taken money that they would have dedicated to child protection, put it someplace else, and reduce their funding for child protection. At a minimum, we don't want to supplant. We don't want to replace what the counties have already committed to that process. Is the language on page 3, 3.22 through 3.28, is that language about going back in and making certain that supplantation did not occur?
Madam Chair, yes.
Okay.
Madam Chair.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's exactly the question and point I was going to make, too, is that I'm hoping that this it does not set up a type of penury or penalizing the counties for taking the responsibility, maybe pulling from other areas to make sure that their child protection system has been set up. And so this was, Mr. McCorder, was this approved by the counties? Obviously, they had say in this portion. This was...
Madam Chair, I can't speak for the county associations. I just know that they were involved in our discussions.
I don't know if the counties are here. I would like to come up and speak to the committee at this time. But we would welcome them to come. Ms. Westland, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Would Senator Rosen repeat her question, please?
Where the county is about the counties, we'd like to hear from the counties in terms of the what's being presented here today.
The counties are very grateful to Senator Sharon for her work in including the funding for these recommendations. The formula was just recently brought together, and it's one that is based in history and has context that the counties have supported in the past, and we are grateful to watch this bill move forward with the funding formula that's included.
Any further questions at this time? Senator Marty.
Just a comment, Madam Chair. First of all, I didn't hear the total amount. I heard $10 million for the Child Protection County Services. How much was the other portion of it?
There's $22 million for the staffing and $10 for... And then in the governor's bill, there's $3 million for special projects related to reducing disparities, which is a recommendation of the task force, but came in the second set of recommendations. In the Senate File 4, there's an amendment that will be coming forward in Finance, too, that requires the department when they're... Remember, in Senate File 4, there's increased supervision of the screeners and improving the guidelines, and we have specific language related to making certain that the guidelines for culturally... sensitive questionings, culturally sensitive interventions are evaluated in that process.
Senator Chair, just to thank you to you and Senator Rosen when we had the earlier thing on the task force report and legislation, I think a lot of us felt that this is a really key part of it, and you said you understood that and you're coming through it. I realize this doesn't make the money happen, but I think this is essential to get with the rest of what you're trying to do done. So,
and I apologize. You know, I just think it's part of the process that we had, that some of the recommendations came in too late for us to really implement them this year, and I don't know if we could have afforded all of them this year anyway. And I mean, this will be a big lift as it is. So I'll look forward to all of your support. And we just simply couldn't get this work done in time for me to meet our deadlines here, so that's why I just offered this as an opportunity to review it now. It'll be going in Finance. Many of us, Senator Hayden, Senator Benson and I, and Senator Rosen, and Senator Laurie are in Finance, so we'll have a chance to have another look at it. But many of us aren't, so I wanted you to have a chance to see it. And if there's anything after this hearing that you look at this, and members who don't have a chance to have another look at it in Finance, please let one of us know. And we really appreciate that. And I can tell you that the work on this by Mr. McCorder has been fabulous. He talks about himself as being very linear. Is that the term you use?
Linear.
Linear. And he is. Let me tell you, he really is. So, you know, he takes all this, all these chickens that are out running around, and sort of brings us back in, and brought us along with the help of Commissioner Koppel to come up with this formula for how we might distribute. That's a difficult part of this, is the formula. Senator Rosen.
Well, and I just would like to say publicly, Senator Sharon, you actually were the instigator of this piece, and really appreciate your work on that. I know you put the due diligence in it, so thank you, along with all the other things to the...
Well, thank you, Senator Rosen. I'm happy to take credit for other people's work. Thank you, Senator Rosen. Alrighty. Anything else then? Well, I appreciate your coming, and we'll see you in Finance Committee. And that concludes our meeting today. Thank you.
Very good. Yeah.